This is the University of Cambridge Local Examinations Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 1997 examination in English as a second language. Paper 4. Listening comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, candidate number, and center number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are six questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each question twice. Question 1. A friend is going to the hospital for a routine checkup. What does her mother remind her to take?
Don't forget to take your new appointment card. The old ones are no good now with the computer system. Don't forget to take your new appointment card. The old ones are no good now with the computer system.
Question 2. Your cousin is celebrating his birthday by taking all his friends to the swimming pool. Where should they meet?
I'll be waiting for you outside the library, so we can all go on there together. I'll be waiting for you outside the library, so we can all go on there together.
Question 3. A customer is returning a jumper to his local store. Why is he not going to receive a refund?
I'm afraid we can't give you a refund on your jumper. It has obviously shrunk, but it is clear from the look and feel of the wool that this jumper was washed in the washing machine and not by hand, as the label tells you to do. I'm afraid we can't give you a refund on your jumper. It has obviously shrunk, but it is clear from the look and feel of the wool that this jumper was washed in the washing machine and not by hand, as the label tells you to do.
Question 4. A student is asking for a reference. What course has she applied for?
Would you be willing to give me a reference? I've applied for a course in fashion design. I know you don't know anything about my academic studies, but you could base your opinion on my work in your shop as an assistant on Saturday mornings. would you be willing to give me a reference? I've applied for a course in fashion design. I know you don't know anything about my academic studies, but you could base your opinion on my work in your shop as an assistant on Saturday mornings.
Question 5. You are met by the caretaker when you arrive at the swimming pool. Where exactly does he suggest you go swimming?
I'm sorry, the swimming pool is closed for redecoration, but you could go to the outdoor pool in Royal Park. It's only a short bus ride away. I'm sorry, the swimming pool is closed for redecoration, but you could go to the outdoor pool in Royal Park. It's only a short bus ride away.
Question 6. A patient is at the doctor's. Why is the doctor not going to prescribe any medicine?
You really need to rest and drink plenty of fluids. There's no point in prescribing a particular medicine, I'm afraid, as I'm sure your cold will clear up by itself.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at part two, exercise one. Part 2, Exercise 1, Question 7. Listen to the following extract about special flights to see the Victoria Falls and complete the notes below. You will hear the extract twice.
Have you ever wondered how birds feel as they soar into the air and look down on the wonders of the world spread out below them? The explorer, the late David Livingstone, said of the Victoria Falls area that it had scenes so lovely they must have been gazed upon by angels in flight. Today, technology offers tourists a grand opportunity to see the Victoria Falls by flying in the unique Pegasus XL Microlite aircraft. The Microlite is a two-seater aircraft with a 50-horsepower engine. The aircraft has no closed cockpit, so the view can't be spoiled, and the flight lasts 15 to 25 minutes. The most suitable time to fly is either early morning or late afternoon. For the safety of passengers, and to make sure of a good view, flights only take place in good weather. Flights are usually cancelled if the weather conditions are adverse, when there are heavy rains, strong winds, or rising heat thermals, for example. The pilot sits in the front of the aircraft and the passenger behind him. During the flight, the passenger will be treated almost as a co-pilot because the controls are in full view and the pilot will discuss the journey with him. Taking off can be unsettling because the Microlite takes only a short trip along the runway before making an elegant leap into the air. Once you are airborne, however, you soon relax and have a really fantastic view of Victoria Falls from various angles. You will be able to see the cascading water, the breathtaking rapids, and the beauty of the rainforests. The flight of the angels
is truly awe-inspiring and well worth the $55 it costs.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Have you ever wondered how birds feel as they soar into the air and look down on the wonders of the world spread out below them? The explorer, the late David Livingstone, said of the Victoria Falls area that it had scenes so lovely they must have been gazed upon by angels in flight. Today, technology offers tourists a grand opportunity to see the Victoria Falls by flying in the unique Pegasus XL Microlite aircraft. The Microlite is a two-seater aircraft with a 50-horsepower engine. The aircraft has no closed cockpit, so the view can't be spoiled, and the flight lasts 15 to 25 minutes. The most suitable time to fly is either early morning or late afternoon. For the safety of passengers, and to make sure of a good view, flights only take place in good weather. Flights are usually cancelled if the weather conditions are adverse, or when there are heavy rains, strong winds, or rising heat thermals, for example. The pilot sits in the front of the aircraft, and the passenger behind him. During the flight, the passenger will be treated almost as a co-pilot, because the controls are in full view and the pilot will discuss the journey with him. Taking off can be unsettling because the Microlite takes only a short trip along the runway before making an elegant leap into the air. Once you are airborne, however, you soon relax and have a really fantastic view of Victoria Falls from various angles. You will be able to see the cascading water, the breathtaking rapids, and the beauty of the rainforests. The flight of the angels is truly awe-inspiring and well worth the $55 it costs.
That is the end of exercise one. In a moment, you will hear exercise two. Now look at the questions for exercise two. Exercise 2. Questions 8 to 16. Listen to the following extract about a special boat in the BT Global Challenge Yacht Race. The speaker is giving a press conference a month before the start of the race. Listen to the talk and complete the notes below. You will hear the talk twice.
Well, thank you all very much for coming here this morning. My name is Alan Gordon, and I've been asked to talk to you about one of the boats in next month's Round the World Yacht Race. You'll all know that the race is called the BT Global Challenge, and that 14 identical steel yachts will compete against each other in what many people believe to be the toughest boat race on Earth. Well, the boats may be identical, but one of them, it's called Time and Tide, is as extraordinary as they come. Every single one of the crew is either disabled or has survived some sort of life-threatening illness. And together they plan to put themselves through 10 months of nerve-jangling danger, exhaustion, and exhilaration. Maybe the best way to explain all of this is to tell you about some of the people who will make up the crew. There's Chris Ogg. He's a parcel company manager from Worcester, who suffers from a very rare progressive wasting disease. We've also got David Hodder, who suffers from so much back pain that he's spent 7 weeks totally immobilized in a plaster jacket. Another crew member is Paul Burns, who, as a soldier, lost a leg in Northern Ireland in 1979. Altogether, there are 11 men and 3 women, including 2 people who have cancer and 1 who is completely deaf. Most experts agree that this race is the ultimate test for even the most experienced, able-bodied sailor, let alone the sort of disabled people that will crew the boat. Now, I'm sure that many of you are wondering how on earth they think they'll make it all the way back to Southampton. Well, as far as the skipper James Hatfield is concerned, the answer is quite simple. They're all good at one thing, and that is survival. It'll be cold, dark, and often terrifying out there, but all the people who were crewed time and tide have already been through bigger battles than the vast majority of ordinary people. The idea of trying to organise an all-disabled crew began in 1992, but throughout the life of the project, the real nightmare has always been money and sponsorship. Even now, with only a few weeks to go before the start, the project is still £100,000 short of its target. Yet the irony is that this boat has stirred up more publicity than all the other boats in the race put together. Perhaps, however, the greatest cost has been to the private lives of the crew members. The boat's skipper, James Hatfield, is a case in point. His fiancée abandoned ship last year because he asked her to postpone their wedding. She said she'd grown to hate the idea of the race, and although she stuck around for a while, she felt she just had to leave him in the end. I'm sure you can appreciate that he felt terrible at the time. But now he seems to feel that it's very important to be able to focus completely on the race and not have any other distractions. All the crew members insist that their disability will make no difference during the race, but the chances are it will. Once the claustrophobic effect of being crammed together in tiny bunks begins to make itself felt, the real test will be how the various personalities get on together. We'd like to win, of course, but if the crew just make it back to Southampton next July, it'll be a tremendous achievement, and I hope that all the newspapers that you represent will acknowledge that. Now, if there are any questions...
Now you will hear the talk again.
Well, thank you all very much for coming here this morning. My name is Alan Gordon, and I've been asked to talk to you about one of the boats in next month's Round the World Yacht Race. You'll all know that the race is called the BT Global Challenge, and that 14 identical steel yachts will compete against each other in what many people believe to be the toughest boat race on Earth. Well, the boats may be identical, but one of them, it's called Time and Tide, is as extraordinary as they come. Every single one of the crew is either disabled or has survived some sort of life-threatening illness. And together they plan to put themselves through 10 months of nerve-jangling danger, exhaustion, and exhilaration. Maybe the best way to explain all of this is to tell you about some of the people who will make up the crew. There's Chris Ogg. He's a parcel company manager from Worcester, who suffers from a very rare progressive wasting disease. We've also got David Hodder, who suffers from so much back pain that he's spent 7 weeks totally immobilized in a plaster jacket. Another crew member is Paul Burns, who, as a soldier, lost a leg in Northern Ireland in 1979. Altogether, there are 11 men and 3 women, including 2 people who have cancer and 1 who is completely deaf. Most experts agree that this race is the ultimate test for even the most experienced, able-bodied sailor, let alone the sort of disabled people that will crew the boat. Now, I'm sure that many of you are wondering how on earth they think they'll make it all the way back to Southampton. Well, as far as the skipper James Hatfield is concerned, the answer is quite simple. They're all good at one thing, and that is survival. It'll be cold, dark, and often terrifying out there, but all the people who will crew Time and Tide have already been through bigger battles than the vast majority of ordinary people. The idea of trying to organise an all-disabled crew began in 1992, but throughout the life of the project, the real nightmare has always been money and sponsorship. Even now, with only a few weeks to go before the start, the project is still £100,000 short of its target. Yet the irony is that this boat has stirred up more publicity than all the other boats in the race put together. Perhaps, however, the greatest cost has been to the private lives of the crew members. The boat's skipper, James Hatfield, is a case in point. His fiancée abandoned ship last year because he asked her to postpone their wedding. She said she'd grown to hate the idea of the race, and although she stuck around for a while, she felt she just had to leave him in the end. I'm sure you can appreciate that he felt terrible at the time. But now he seems to feel that it's very important to be able to focus completely on the race and not have any other distractions. All the crew members insist that their disability will make no difference during the race, but the chances are it will. Once the claustrophobic effect of being cramped together in tiny bunks begins to make itself felt, the real test will be how the various personalities get on together. We'd like to win, of course, but if the crew just make it back to Southampton next July, it'll be a tremendous achievement, and I hope that all the newspapers that you represent will acknowledge that. Now, if there are any questions...
On the other hand, we also get overconfident types who joke around or make fun, which isn't very appropriate.
That is the end of exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for exercise 2. Exercise 2. questions 22 to 26. Listen to the following radio extract in which the editor of a local newspaper talks about his newspaper and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice.
Local newspapers depend on their ability to reflect the interests and concerns of their immediate community. Because of this, a local newspaper like mine can't afford to be too political in flavour. Unlike many national papers, we don't represent political interests in a particularly big way. We can't afford to annoy a large percentage of our readership. A lot of the revenue for the paper comes, of course, from advertising. The staff of a local newspaper consists of a number of reporters, features writers, and sub-editors. And, of course, there is a chief editor. All journalists must be able to recognize a good story, write well and accurately, and communicate effectively. I often get inquiries from students wishing to enter journalism, and I always tell them to get experience writing for their school magazine, contributing to local news sheets, or writing letters to the press. Any of that will give them good pre-job training. If you do get a job on a local newspaper, it's widely recognized as a very good start to a career in journalism. It offers an excellent all-round training and plenty of real-life experience. However, there's a lot of pressure to meet deadlines. Some reporters work until midnight preparing news items for the following day, so it's definitely not the best job for someone who crumbles under pressure or wants a 9-to-5 job. As an editor, I get a lot of pleasure from producing an excellent newspaper on time and knowing that the readers will welcome and enjoy it. I have a regular conference at 2:45 p.m. each afternoon when we look ahead to news prospects for the following day. All around me, the news offices are buzzing with life. Reporters are writing up stories or out covering jobs. Meetings are taking place about features, advertising, etc. The production department is dealing with a steady flow of material and feeding it into the computer, deciding on how it will be laid out and so on. Our local town is small and relatively peaceful, so there is little actual crime to report. News items tend to be offbeat, slightly bizarre. Unlike many local papers, we devote an unusually large amount of space to reporting national and international news, and we have a wide range of feature articles, such as fashion, food, families, and issues that our readers are worried about, such as new roads being built or housing developments.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Local newspapers depend on their ability to reflect the interests and concerns of their immediate community. Because of this, a local newspaper like mine can't afford to be too political in flavour. Unlike many national papers, we don't represent political interests in a particularly big way. We can't afford to annoy a large percentage of our readership. A lot of the revenue for the paper comes, of course, from advertising. The staff of a local newspaper consists of a number of reporters, features writers, and sub-editors. And, of course, there is a chief editor. All journalists must be able to recognize a good story, write well and accurately, and communicate effectively. I often get inquiries from students wishing to enter journalism, and I always tell them to get experience writing for their school magazine, contributing to local news sheets, or writing letters to the press. Any of that will give them good pre-job training. If you do get a job on a local newspaper, it's widely recognised as a very good start to a career in journalism. It offers an excellent all-round training and plenty of real-life experience. However, there's a lot of pressure to meet deadlines. Some reporters work until midnight preparing news items for the following day, so it's definitely not the best job for someone who crumbles under pressure or wants a 9-to-5 job. As an editor, I get a lot of pleasure from producing an excellent newspaper on time and knowing that the readers will welcome and enjoy it. I have a regular conference at 2:45 p.m. each afternoon when we look ahead to news prospects for the following day. All around me, the news offices are buzzing with life. Reporters are writing up stories or out covering jobs. Meetings are taking place about features, advertising, etc. The production department is dealing with a steady flow of material and feeding it into the computer, deciding on how it will be laid out and so on.
Tony, lots of school and college leavers become very nervous about going to an interview. Have you got any tips you'd like to pass on?
Well, first, I'd like to reassure them and say that being selected for an interview is a compliment. They're fortunate to have got that far.
Right.
It means the company has already assessed your written application and picked you out of a lot of other hopeful applicants. Being invited for an interview helps them make the final choice between you and the other candidates.
I'm sure they'll be glad to hear that. But what kind of questions can they expect?
Actually, interviewing students is very hard for us. They don't usually have the work history which we would refer to with older candidates.
Yeah.
But I try my best to put them at ease and ask questions I expect them to answer well. But in return, I do expect a conversation. I've got some very decided pet hates. There is nothing I object to more than getting a one-word answer. Or, and it does happen, a blank stare.
Oh, dear. So how can you make a good impression? Research tells us that many interviewers make up their minds about a candidate in the first minute.
Well, that sounds a bit far-fetched to me. You need to look smart and tidy, but there's no need to spend a lot of money on a brand new outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you should try to arrive on time, and I'm not too keen on people, you know, being too relaxed, such as lolling about in a chair or sitting down first without waiting for an invitation.
Yeah. Is it a good idea to prepare before going to an interview?
Oh, most definitely. You should double-check the transport arrangements you'll need to make, and you should try to find out as much as you can about the company.
Right.
The public library can be a good source of information, and you'll probably be sent information about the company which you need to read carefully.
Mm. So, what are typical questions an interviewer asks?
Well, of course, it's hard to generalise, but I'd say that questions such as, tell us something about yourself, and what qualities can you offer us?
Yeah.
I mean, personal qualities of the candidate. Also, probably something about ambition. What is your ideal career ambition, for instance?
What questions can a candidate ask?
It's useful to ask, say, what exactly are my duties going to be?
Mm.
You could ask about training or promotion prospects, and who would be in charge of you. Often we get candidates who are afraid to ask any questions, which is a shame. On the other hand, we also get overconfident types who joke around or make fun, which isn't very appropriate.
That is the end of exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for exercise 2. Exercise 2, questions 22 to 26. Listen to the following radio extract in which the editor of a local newspaper talks about his newspaper and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice.
Local newspapers depend on their ability to reflect the interests and concerns of their immediate community. Because of this, a local newspaper like mine can't afford to be too political in flavour. Unlike many national papers, we don't represent political interests in a particularly big way. We can't afford to annoy a large percentage of our readership. A lot of the revenue for the paper comes, of course, from advertising. The staff of a local newspaper consists of a number of reporters, features writers, and sub-editors. And, of course, there is a chief editor. All journalists must be able to recognize a good story, write well and accurately, and communicate effectively. I often get inquiries from students wishing to enter journalism, and I always tell them to get experience writing for their school magazine, contributing to local news sheets, or writing letters to the press. Any of that will give them good pre-job training. If you do get a job on a local newspaper, it's widely recognised as a very good start to a career in journalism. It offers an excellent all-round training and plenty of real-life experience. However, there's a lot of pressure to meet deadlines. Some reporters work until midnight, preparing news items for the following day, so it's definitely not the best job for someone who crumbles under pressure or wants a 9-to-5 job. As an editor, I get a lot of pleasure from producing an excellent newspaper on time and knowing that the readers will welcome and enjoy it. I have a regular conference at 2:45 p.m. each afternoon when we look ahead to news prospects for the following day. All around me, the news offices are buzzing with life. Reporters are writing up stories or out covering jobs. Meetings are taking place about features, advertising, etc. The production department is dealing with a steady flow of material and feeding it into the computer, deciding on how it will be laid out and so on. Our local town is small and relatively peaceful, so there is little actual crime to report, News items tend to be offbeat, slightly bizarre. Unlike many local papers, we devote an unusually large amount of space to reporting national and international news, and we have a wide range of feature articles, such as fashion, food, families, and issues that our readers are worried about, such as new roads being built or housing developments.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Local newspapers depend on their ability to reflect the interests and concerns of their immediate community. Because of this, a local newspaper like mine can't afford to be too political in flavour. Unlike many national papers, we don't represent political interests in a particularly big way. We can't afford to annoy a large percentage of our readership. A lot of the revenue for the paper comes, of course, from advertising. The staff of a local newspaper consists of a number of reporters, features writers, and sub-editors. And, of course, there is a chief editor. All journalists must be able to recognize a good story, write well and accurately, and communicate effectively. I often get inquiries from students wishing to enter journalism, and I always tell them to get experience writing for their school magazine, contributing to local news sheets, or writing letters to the press. Any of that will give them good pre-job training. If you do get a job on a local newspaper, it's widely recognized as a very good start to a career in journalism. It offers an excellent all-round training and plenty of real-life experience. However, there's a lot of pressure to meet deadlines. Some reporters work until midnight, preparing news items for the following day, so it's definitely not the best job for someone who crumbles under pressure or wants a 9-to-5 job. As an editor, I get a lot of pleasure from producing an excellent newspaper on time and knowing that the readers will welcome and enjoy it. I have a regular conference at 2:45 p.m. each afternoon when we look ahead to news prospects for the following day. All around me, the news offices are buzzing with life. Reporters are writing up stories or out covering jobs. Meetings are taking place about features, advertising, etc. The production department is dealing with a steady flow of material and feeding it into the computer, deciding on how it will be laid out and so on. Our local town is small and relatively peaceful, so there is little actual crime to report. News items tend to be offbeat, slightly bizarre. Unlike many local papers, we devote an unusually large amount of space to reporting national and international news, and we have a wide range of feature articles, such as fashion, food, families, and issues that our readers are worried about, such as new roads being built or housing developments.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.